And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Today's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and we invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends in the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has had since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, welcome back again for another edition of Bird Calls.
Well, this is a special episode because not just the pledge drive is going on around us, but it's our sixth anniversary. This show was born 6 years ago this month, June of 2013. How about that?
That's a long, long time to be on the air with Bird Calls.
Yeah.
But it's been fun, and we have had just so many good shows, a lot of fun callers, and we just enjoy working with everybody. It's just fun, and it's, you know, I learned something every time we go on air.
And it's stuff that you see around you. You might not be paying attention to the birds singing around you or flying around you, but we also talk about not only what they are, what they look like, what they sound like, but what they do out there. And sometimes they're working for us and working for free, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. Little teaser there.
There you go. Well, at the end of last month's show, you gave us a conservation tip, and I'm going to give the numbers out again, and then we'll go to that conservation tip review. Cliff is going to take your calls tonight about birds in our avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. If you have a bird that you would like Cliff to identify, you can send an audio sample or a photograph to me at W Beckett with two T's at lsus.edu, and we'll have those on the next show. Remind us of our conservation tip from last month.
Yeah, we talked about limiting noise pollution, and first of all, you have to define what noise pollution is, and it's the harmful or annoying levels of noise as from heavy machinery, airplanes, industry, etc. And so a lot of that can be disruptive to birds and cause undue stress, especially in the breeding season, the nesting season. If you know where a bald eagle nest is, or a heronry with a bunch of egrets and herons and other wading birds, or even just a backyard songbird, you just want to tread lightly, because the problem is you can scare a bird off the nest and it might not come back for a while, and it's not going to abandon it, but it's going to have to wait till things kind of calm down. But every moment that nest is exposed, in a heronry, for example, there might not be shade on those eggs, and they can get pretty hot.
Mm-hmm.
So in a lot of cases, mama bird, papa bird are shading the eggs so they don't get too hot. And so we want to make sure we avoid that. And so when you're out in the great outdoors, you want to listen to the sounds that you're making and try to minimize them as to not create noise pollution, especially when you're around sensitive wildlife. And that's what we talked about last month.
All right. And as always, we have a profile species. And could you tell us what we've got this week?
The species we're profiling tonight is the barn swallow, B-A-R-N. And let's begin by listening to their chattering calls.
That is a cacophony.
Yeah, there's two or three individuals at least in that recording. In the U.S., we have eight species of regularly occurring swallows and martins. The barn swallow is one of the more widespread species. They're fast flyers that are dark above, pale below, with a reddish-brown throat and a long, deeply forked tail. Swallows, while in flight, eat a lot of pesky insects. And barn swallows, like so many of our insectivorous birds, are highly migratory, leaving our listening area during the colder months and returning in March and April to spend the next 6 or 7 warmer months with us. Most barn swallows winter in the tropics way south of us. When not flying around, swallows often take a break by sitting on power lines, and they'll sometimes do this in groups, especially near a breeding colony. Sometimes called mud swallows because they build their nests of mud and place them near humans, including under porches, bridges, open barns or warehouses, and the like. Keep in mind that there are other species that could qualify as a mud swallow, namely the cliff swallow, but they look quite different, plus their nest architecture is different from the barn swallow. When these mud swallows find a muddy spot near their nest site, they don't use their feet to haul the mud. Instead, they scoop a small amount of it in their bill and fly to the nest site. And they must do this hundreds of times over several days until the open, cup-shaped nest is finally finished and ready for eggs to be laid. Most nests become dry and brittle before the next breeding season, so they typically won't remain standing a second year. If you have them nesting under your porch or your carport and you don't like the pile of poop that they leave, instead of getting upset with them, try embracing them, since while foraging on pesky insects, they're working for you and they're working for free. Let them do their job of pest control. If those poop piles annoy you, do what a friend of mine does by placing a large, shallow pan of kitty litter at the spot of the largest poop pileup. And keep in mind that unlike our pet dogs and cats, bird poop is quite odorless. To see a photograph of a barn swallow snapped by James Childress of Lufkin, please go to the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
And that is a gorgeous photo, by the way. I really like the coloring on that and everything. I'm envious, so, you know, yeah. There you go. Give us a call, 800-552-8502. You're listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. He will take your calls about birds in the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we do have our first caller online, Clay. We're not sure where he's from, but he's online. Clay, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hi, I'm from Shreveport, and I was recently watching a documentary at the Robinson Film Center about farming called The Biggest Little Farm. And one of the efforts they made as farmers were to attract barn owls to their farm. They put up boxes for that purpose. And I wonder if Cliff could comment on whether it's possible or likely to attract barn owls or owls of any type to an urban setting in Shreveport by establishing or putting up, building a box and attaching it to a structure like a large oak tree, perhaps.
Great.
Or some other structure. Yeah. I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer. Great. And I appreciate your show. I've enjoyed it for 6 years now.
Oh, great. Thank cool. you, Clay. And that's a great question about the farmers attracting owls. And so the barn owl is a notorious hunter of rodents. And so rodents, of course, are sometimes out there collecting the crop, digging up the seeds, eating off the corn, or getting into the barn and eating the store of food. So a barn owl is going to be a really good friend to a farmer that has issues with rodents. Now, that only works in prairie grassland, really open conditions. So that the barn owl won't be in forested settings. So your question asks, what could you do in urban settings? And unless you're out on a farm where it's very open, you probably don't have barn owls. So it will have limited use in urban settings, if it's very forested. But you can attract screech owls And actually, the screech owls are probably already in your city throughout most of the listening area. And they are going to use a cavity, like a hollow from an old woodpecker created cavity or limb rot. And you can kind of imitate or emulate that with a nest box or a roost box and put that up. And then you know the screech owls there because you can see him sitting in the entrance, maybe peeking his head out. So that screech owl might be really good at keeping small mice at bay. They also eat large wood roaches. So the screech owl is a really good predator of those. But back to the original comment, I think that's a great idea for farmers out in really open country, like rice country, for example. That would work. There are barn owls down on the prairie, coastal prairie, what we call the Cajun prairie in this state. And so Lafayette and westward. And then in my state, along the whole coastal prairie, Beaumont, Houston, and on down the coast, barn owl boxes would work really well. And parts of the prairie country to our north and northeast, you know, in Mount Vernon area, for example, there are barn owls up in that area. Celeste, Texas, Greenville, Texas, where you get into open prairie country. But yeah, let owls do their job. Let them work for you. Let them work for free. And you know, for a few bucks, you can put up a box and attract those birds, and it's a great idea. And a great question from Clay of Shreveport. Thank you for calling.
And they're also night shift workers, so you really don't have
That's
to bother
right.
with them during the day, you know. So they
That's
come
right.
in and they do their job while you're sleeping.
Yep, that's right. And so with some of those barn owl box designs, you can actually, from afar, look in with a scope or binoculars and see the barn owls in there. They don't, those box designs don't, most of them don't go deep, and so the hole is very shallow and you can see in, and so in the daytime those owls are sleeping, so you can often see them in there sleeping away, and you know what happens, like you said, when it gets dark, they're waking up and ready for breakfast when most of us are headed to bed.
Well, they just happen to have third shift. You
yeah.
are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. You will get in right away. There are no calls waiting, so we would love to hear from you. Call in now. And in the meantime, we had a gentleman who took some really nice photographs of a bird, and he sent them in, and you can see these on our website. And Cliff, what exactly is this bird?
Did this guy nail pictures of this bird? It's at his feeder. He's got two male rose-breasted grosbeaks, which are a fairly common migrant in our listening area in the springtime. That period is done and gone. These birds have passed through our area, but if you are looking out at your seed feeder in mid to late April, or maybe even the first 15 days of May, you could see one of these. And this person photographed, it's a beautiful black and white bird with this very red chest. It looks like it's got a bleeding heart, mm-hmm. and that's the male. And again, it's the rose-breasted grosbeak. So go online on our Bird Calls page and look at the pictures. They're beautiful bird. And that is a bird that passes through our area. They don't winter here. They don't nest here. They're simply passing through in fall and spring is the best time to see them.
And he got some wonderful shots. He had to have a very good zoom camera, because I doubt that they would have let him get that close. He's literally right up in the face of one of them, and that was when I opened it up. I was like, whoa, you know, I got a pair of eyes staring back at me.
Yeah, and he's probably using his house as a blind
right.
and a hide, so he's in the kitchen behind the window and using that telephoto lens, I'm guessing, because you're right. It's full frame. If the bird is much more jumbo than lifelike in these pictures, it's, you know, it's the size of a small dog on the page.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. One caller online right now, Jay from Lufkin. You're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, Cliff, this is Jay Thornton. How are you?
Hey, we just said your name a few minutes ago, Jay.
Yeah, I was listening to you when I was coming home, and it reminded me to donate.
All right. Well, thanks for doing that. And because of that, we named a bird after you, the Blue Jay.
I'm sure you did.
We're very nice that way.
I was calling to ask a question.
Okay.
Back in the 70s, when I was younger in East Texas, we had these large woodpeckers.
Uh-huh.
We called them chicken woodpeckers.
Uh-huh.
And I don't see them anymore, and I'm sure that's not the real name, but
right.
What happened to those birds?
Well, the chicken, the better name or the more commonly used name was Indian hen. Indian for the drumming, and hen, H-E-N, for the clucking sound they make. And so maybe Bill can find the pileated woodpecker clucking sound, the cluck, 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 cluck.
Okay, so that's a pileated, huh?
Yeah, it's a pileated. So that's your bird, Jay.
There
and they're still around. Let's hear if this is... Nope, not that recording. Let's try it.
Okay, we don't have another
there it
report.
Is. There it is. Ah. There's the clucking. And so old-timers would hear that and thought it was a chicken out in the woods. And then they'd hear the drumming, the brrrr, and that's where the Indian part came from. Sounded like someone drumming on their drum out in the woods. So I'm guessing what you're thinking of is the Indian hen, and they're still alive and well and doing quite well in East Texas. And I still see and hear them in my backyard on occasion and around town. So I'm always delighted when I see or hear a pileated woodpecker.
Well, I live in town, so maybe just since I don't live out by the lake anymore, they're probably not more prominent in the city. But
yeah.
We saw them when we were younger, and they were large.
Right.
I haven't seen one in many years. So.
Yeah, they're crow-sized, just not as husky, as stocky as a crow. They're a lot leaner. But they are certainly a big woodpecker.
Well, good. I appreciate you answering my question.
Hey, thanks, Jay, for the call.
I hope you enjoyed the barbecue.
All right.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. 800-552-8502. Toastmasters are answering the phone tonight along with Wally Derleth. And we would love to just fill up the banks with phone calls right now. So please go ahead and give us a call. We do have another caller online, Cindy from Nacogdoches. You're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Okay, my question is, could Cliff comment on how to encourage pigeons to leave a barn?
How about closing the doors? I know that's
okay.
That's hard to do. There's
a lot. It's actually a stable.
Yeah, there are a lot of gimmicks out there for that. You know, they say, oh, this owl decoy will scare pigeons away. I've seen plenty of pigeons practically sitting on top of that owl decoy, so they don't work. You know, rubber snakes don't work. There's a product called Nixolite or porcupine wire, and it's basically big spiny things that you can buy. It's pretty expensive and put them up on all the perches. But it's just difficult. If you've got all the ingredients of what a pigeon wants, and that's a high perch up in the rafters and probably some waste grain or feed somewhere that they can pick and find food, then you've got really everything they like. So I wasn't kidding about closing the door, but I know that's not possible for a lot of people. But there's really nothing else. I don't like the gimmicks of what I mentioned, the rubber snakes, the owl decoys. There's even products out there that I don't even want to list because they're just cuckoo. And I think that, you know, people can be sucked into cuckoo-ness if they try buying it. So, yeah, so you've created a really perfect place for pigeons, and I don't know what to tell you except maybe embracing them.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks so much.
Okay, thanks, Cindy.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have all lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Go ahead and give us a call. You will get right in. And in the meantime, We did have someone say they had heard bird names like jug blower and Indian hen, which you just mentioned, but those names don't match anything in his bird books. So what are these names, and what are these specific birds?
Yeah, and Jay called about one of those colloquial names, what we call an old-timer name. And sometimes you'll talk to that old grandpa that refers to names that he grew up with, or maybe grandma grew up with, and they have old-timer names that don't match up in the books. And I really like them, like the Indian hen that we talked about already for pileated woodpecker. And you mentioned another one, jug blower. That's a great colloquial name for the great horned owl.
Oh. Okay.
And it sounds like you're slowly blowing air over a jug of moonshine, maybe. And so that's where he got that name. Timberdoodle, that's a name we sometimes hear, especially folks that know what a woodcock is.
Okay.
And, you know, there's a lot of other colloquial names. One of my favorites is probably the American bittern, because it has so many colloquial names. Bog thumper and all kinds of references to their call, which we've never profiled that bird. And it calls at night, and so that makes it very unique. So people, you know, in the daytime when there's 15 species singing all at once, you tune it out. But when it's at night and you hear a nightjar or an owl or this bittern calling at night, you pay attention, because you know it's not a frog and it's something unique. So, yeah, those are colloquial names, and there are a lot of them. It's kind of a lost language almost, because old-timers, you know, when they pass away, if they don't pass on those names, they're often forgotten. So I encourage you, if you've got old-timer names in your head and you've got grandkids, teach them the correct name and the colloquial name, the old-timer name. You know, say, hey, buddy, this is a pileated woodpecker. He's also known as the Indian hen. And did you hear that last night? That was a great horned owl. It's also known as the jug blower. So that's the only way to pass down that language, is to tell the next generation what those names are.
And the Chuckwill Widow would go into that night bird. You know, and are whippoorwills night birds?
They're not. Okay. They're both night birds. Yeah, they both are. Yeah, and those two don't have colloquial names, because they're so iconic. So, right. You know, they're onomatopoeic. They're named after their vocalization. So they're easy enough. They don't really need a colloquial name. Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. If you have a photo or a bird sound that you would like us to identify on the next show, we won't get to it tonight, but send it to us at W. Beckett, and Beckett is spelled with two T's, B-E-C-K-E-T-T, at lsus.edu. That's W. Beckett at lsus.edu, and we'll get that on the next show. We have another caller online, Ellen from Bossier. Ellen, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
All the way down by Elk Grove area, and we had seen some red-winged blackbird out that day, but then all of a sudden this bird flew over that it had like orange patches. It was black, but then it had orange patches all on its back, and it flew over us and landed in a tree, and we both tried to Google it, but we couldn't figure out what type of bird it was, and we were just wondering what it might have been.
So there are a couple species of orioles. Could it have been a Baltimore oriole maybe flying over? There are super orange. They're not a shade of orange. They're just like the fruit orange color, even brighter. Was it like that?
It was really orange, like what you're talking about. And we did think it might have been an oriole. But most of the orange was on the back instead of the breast area. So that's what we're like. So even the wings seem to have like a patch on each wing.
Yeah.
They're down the back.
Well, there are other species of orioles that we have around that have color, but not like that. Like the orchard oriole, the male is a burgundy, kind of a deep, dark chestnut wood color, so that doesn't sound like your bird. I can't really think of anything with just orange in the wings, especially if it's flying away from you. There's also the northern flicker, but you have to go west of here till you really pick up the red-shafted form. There are very few records of the red-shafted flicker this far east. And you wouldn't see that red necessarily if it's flying away from you, because okay. It's underneath the bird, and so it's really hard to see that if it's flying away from you. So just based on that bright orange color, I'm going to have to go with Baltimore Oriole. Is really the only thing I can think of with that bright color like that. And they're not much bigger, roughly about the same size as the red-winged blackbird. Pretty close in size. Yeah. And they migrate through. They nest very locally in tiny numbers. It's really hard to find a nesting Baltimore Oriole in the listening area, but they sure do pour through here in April and May. So I'm guessing your bird was a Baltimore Oriole.
Okay, interesting. Thanks so much.
All right, thanks, Ellen.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. It's funny, Baltimore Oriole, I would think that would be an eastern bird up in the Baltimore area, obviously. It's just a misnomer, but does that live here year-round?
It does in very tiny numbers. Actually, somebody sent me pictures. I've forgotten who it was. Sent me pictures. They had two individual Baltimore Orioles spend the winter with them here in Shreveport. And going to their feeder, they asked what to provide, and I told them about the grape jelly technique. Orioles really like to eat grape jelly for some reason. People that live up north in Minnesota and Wisconsin, they know that really well, and they put out little saucers of grape jelly for the orioles. Of course, the bees like it too.
Yeah.
So, but those two can coexist, but. So typically Baltimore Orioles are not here in the winter. I would say 99.9% of them are gone, except this lucky person who had them wintering, not just one wintering with them, but two is super cool, super unusual. So that's a really neat thing. So
where do they winter at then?
Most of them winter in Latin America and southern Mexico and points farther south. And so they basically leave our cold area and head for warmer climate during our cold winter months.
So they get to vacation in Latin America.
Yeah, yeah.
Lucky them.
Yep.
So there you go. Unlike teachers who vacation over the summer. So,
That's right. That's right.
The birds take their siesta, their break in the wintertime. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now. You'll get right in, 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502, and we would love to have you on with us right now. In the meantime, we have a question here. Somebody wanted to know what wildscaping means. They had heard this on a show, but they weren't really sure what you were talking about.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot, and it's such a good thing to do in your yard. It's really a different way of thinking about what you provide in your garden for wildlife. It's basically landscaping for wildlife. It's not just putting things out because it's green or it has some pretty flowers. It actually has meaning to wildlife. In other words, it might be nectar giving, and so you'll see butterflies and hummingbirds because of that. Or it'll be berry giving, and you'll see cedar waxwings and robins and mockingbirds coming in to eat the berries. And then cover in general. When you have thickets of native vegetation, that might be where vireos and warblers are going to be during certain times of the year looking for insects that are in those thickets. So to answer the question, wildscaping is backyard landscaping for wildlife, and it's really looking at the value of each plant you put in, and namely native species, and that again that they have some value to wildlife, and also provide color. You know, you can't beat Turk's cap. It's a beautiful plant, provides a bright green leaf with a red flower, and butterflies and hummingbirds love them. They are one of the late wildflowers to bloom, but they also are one of the last to keep blooming. So if you've got hummingbirds that are lingering into November, you can still have Turk's cap blooming, and that can be providing food for them. So that's another thing to research, is what is blooming and when, because you don't want all your plants to bloom at the same time, because sometimes blooming is short-lived. You want to make sure you've staggered your blooms, so something at most of the time there's something blooming at all points, except dead of winter when nothing is blooming. But for this far south, we've got 9 or 10 months where you can have something blooming, and you just have to do a little research to see what those plants would be. You know, something like the red buckeye, it blooms first. And it's probably not coincidental that our first ruby-throated hummingbirds that show up in mid-March coincide with the bloom of the red buckeye. So it's really fun. I think, you know, wildscaping is not something you're going to accomplish in a 3-day weekend. It's something you're going to just keep doing the rest of your life. And it's basically providing habitat for wildlife. And wildlife means critters. You know, butterflies are wildlife. Hummingbirds are wildlife.
Bees
are wildlife. It's just, wildlife is another term for animal. So, you know, a lot of people think wildlife has to be something you shoot with a gun and serve on the dinner table. And that's correct, but it's not exclusive to that. It includes a whole lot of other critters out there. So I encourage people to wildscape. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of doing. And it's very rewarding. And it's something you will get hooked on. You'll see the benefit we have in our house, in our yard, and the previous yard we had when we lived in Central Texas. I guarantee we had birds that no neighbor would have had, because we provided cover and those plants that gave back to wildlife.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. We're going next to Clyde from Nacogdoches. Clyde, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, it actually deals with a colloquial name. The wife says that her mother used to talk about something that she called a bull bat, and we don't know what it was.
Yeah.
Do you?
I sure do. The bull bat is the common night hawk.
Ah!
And he's a night jar, and he's not just flying about at night. They can be at dawn and dusk. And actually, you can see them migrating during the day in May. That's one of our last migrants to pour through mid to late May. Again, it's the common nighthawk, and the bull bat is, it's part of the goat sucker family. That's maybe
right.
Another term you've heard of. People see these nighthawks foraging around the goats, and you know, they're flying around eating insects, bugs, and flies that are pesky around the goat. But people looked at that and said, oh, look, they're flying underneath the goat, and they're suckling from the goat. They're a goat sucker. And that's how that name came about. It's, of course, very incorrect, but it's a great name. But the bull bat is doing that, flying around cattle, maybe, or above cattle, not usually at cattle. But that's the species that your mother-in-law, you said?
My mother-in-law.
Yeah, your mother-in-law.
She is.
Yep.
Can't ask her anymore.
Okay. But that's the species she was referring to, and that's a great colloquial name, the bull bat. Thanks, Clyde.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
We love your program.
Oh, great.
Always listen.
All right, great. Thank you, Clyde.
Uh-huh. Have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now. We have lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have the next caller, Kelly from Corrigan, Texas, and you are online with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, you mentioned, hello.
Hey.
First of all, hello.
Hey.
Use my manners. You mentioned disturbing the nest with sounds and what have you.
Right.
And you mentioned the bald eagle, which led me to a conversation I was having with our rural mail carrier.
Okay.
She has reported seeing a bald eagle on her route.
Mm-hmm.
The last couple of years, we've seen a bald eagle near our home. So I asked her where she was seeing this eagle, and she told me, and it's like 3 or 4 miles from where we typically see it. What is the range of, if you have an eagle's nest, a bald eagle's nest, what is their range?
It's huge, and
really?
They can nest on one lake and fly to a nearby lake or pond on occasion, and so that's a big bird, and you know, getting from, say, Kurth Lake to Sam Rayburn is a piece of cake, or in your case, Lake Livingston to the Trinity River. Of course, the Trinity feeds that lake, but there are all kinds of...
More than likely, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's all right.
We also see, we've also seen a bald eagle around the Neches River, where it crosses 59.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, fairly close to us.
Yeah, and I would say that your bald eagle could probably occur in a 20-mile radius circle.
Wow.
Easily. I don't think that's pushing it for that bird at all. But another thing to think about is in Texas, we have over 300 nesting pairs of bald eagles, mostly in the eastern third of the state. So, and that wasn't the case in the 1970s. We were only at about 7 pair. And so the bird has really rebounded and done well. And so you could have multiple pairs depending on where you live. If you get closer to Houston, where you've got lots of lakes like Conroe, Lake Houston, you got several rivers, there are lots of bald eagle pairs in the Houston area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you've been very helpful.
Okay. Well, Kelly from Corgan, thank you.
And I enjoy NPR, period.
Excellent. Thank you, Kelly.
So, you have a good evening.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. You'll get in right away because we have no calls waiting online. So in the meantime, we did have another question from online. This was not concerning birds, but wild hogs. And they were wondering whether nature enthusiasts should be concerned about wild hogs increasing on the landscape.
You bet. I mean, that is one of the number one things that I've recommended. We've done it on this show, is controlling feral hogs. We've talked about that. That was one of our conservation tips. That species right there is not native. It's something that when I was a kid was not really a problem, but in the last 40 years has just exploded, especially the last 20 years. And every 10 years, it's getting worse because they're just prolific at breeding and getting into stuff. And so you might think, oh, they're cute and harmless. Not really. Mm. They're not supposed to be here, and they're rooting up future habitat. So they can get into crops, of course, and create a mess. And they cause millions of dollars in damage from crops every year. But also what I don't like is they're also getting into ground nesting birds. They'll eat anything. So if they come across a nest of turkeys, quail, meadowlarks, or anything low to the ground, they'll eat them. And so they're also, of course, trampling and rooting up future habitat. So they're super destructive. We should be concerned, and there's easy solution. It's something you can collect annually, daily. And you should applaud people that do pig control. You can do trapping, shooting. You really have to bring out all the big guns for that one. And, mm-hmm. and I don't mean guns literally, but I'm talking about it's becoming a war with feral hogs. You have to bring out all the different techniques to remove them, and that usually means trapping and shooting. And so, yes, we should be concerned, and there's a solution, and it would be good to do so.
And they actually, they were brought, were they not, by the Spanish conquistadors?
They were brought as food. They were domesticated, and then people started letting them out and fattening them up that way. Instead of putting them in fenced corrals or pens, they'd let them run the bottoms certain times of the year and go out and eat acorns. Well, they're competing with native species. Right. They're eating acorns on the ground that deer are supposed to get, wild turkey are supposed to be getting, squirrels, etc. So here you're adding all these hungry mouths out in the fields and in the woods that are competing with native species.
I wonder why they've exploded in the last 20 to 40 years.
Because they breed like rabbits.
Okay.
And they can have their first litter in just a few months, and the female can keep breeding religiously multiple times a year, and
wow.
And she can have large litters each time. So one feral hog can turn into 50 in short order, and so that's where it comes from.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We do have a caller online, Sean from Troop, Texas. You're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, sir. I actually had two questions. One is if Cliff knows what a chaparral is.
Uh-huh. I do.
Okay, I learned that from my grandfather. He lived out in Throckmorton.
Uh-huh.
And I was very surprised when I moved here, and I just actually, I'm on my way home from work and saw one run across the road. I see them all the time.
Right.
And I was very surprised to see them in East Texas, because I always thought they were more of a drier, you know, an arid desert type.
That's right. So the chaparral is the greater roadrunner. And so Throckmorton is a better place. That's out near the Rolling Plains, between Fort Worth and Wichita Falls, roughly. And that's a great place for roadrunners. But we have opened up the Piney Woods in the last 100 years, and roadrunners have taken advantage of that. And they've moved eastward. And they've even conquered the Mississippi River, and probably have run across some of the big bridges to get to the other side. That's a pretty long way for a roadrunner to fly the Mississippi River, but they are pretty good flyers. But it's because of opening up the forests and clearing it have we made it conducive for roadrunners in this listening area. Yeah.
I always know that my grandfather loved having them around because they ate snakes or killed snakes. I don't know if they ate them.
Oh, yeah.
I know they killed them. And
they ate them.
Scorpions and all kinds of
things.
That's
right.
Like that. So
yeah.
Great to have around your property.
That's right. They are a good neighbor to have. So what was your other question, Sean?
I was wanting to know if you went to SFA in the late 80s.
I did. Did we go to school together?
I lived across the hall from you in Hall 14.
Oh, wow. The zoo.
For a very brief period. I cannot for the life of me remember your roommate's name. He had a Mustang. I remember that.
Yeah, that was John Chassel.
That's right. Oh,
yep.
Gosh, I haven't
wow.
thought of his name in forever. But I heard your name. I moved back to this part of Texas a few years ago, and I heard your name on the radio. And I said, there's not another Cliff Shackleford.
No.
are you
tall with red hair?
No.
No?
Short with, now I don't have much hair anymore, but
okay.
I had dark brown hair. I lived with Scott Faust, and I can't remember if he was my roommate at the time.
Yeah.
When we lived across the hall from you guys.
Gosh, it's only been 35 years, right?
I'm lucky I can remember what I had.
Yeah.
It's a class reunion.
Yeah, that's awesome. So we lived in the zoo together. I heard they're going to tear that dormitory down soon, and they should. It was old. It was old when we were there in the 80s, wasn't it?
It was. I didn't know if you'd remember it being called the zoo or not, but
I
might have got some of your ornithology studies
yeah.
in there.
Yeah, and you know why they called it the zoo? Because it was wild and crazy.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's a lot of reasons they called it that. I know one guy had a 9-foot boa living in his drawers.
Yeah,
there was all kinds of stuff in there. But I was just wondering. I was pretty sure that was you.
That's cool. Awesome, Sean. Well, it's good to hear from you, man.
Good to hear from you.
Yeah.
I like hearing your voice every now and then.
Hey, man, great. I appreciate that.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Sean. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. So that was your animal house, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think I was an RA in a dorm like that once, because I was an RA for 3 years in college. Yeah. Well, we've got more calls on the line. We want to get your call in, so you need to call in now while we have time at 800-552-8502. 800-552-8502. We have a band in our studio warming up for a live show tonight at 8, and we have about 15 minutes left with Cliff, and we're going to go to Tanya from Huntington, Texas. Tanya, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, thank y'all for taking my call.
You bet.
I have a quick question. So this weekend, I don't know if you know where Fort Turan is on the Neches River, but we rode down there, and it's so secluded, and it's so beautiful down there. And we came across these tracks on the sandbar, and they looked like huge bird tracks. They're as big as my hand. And the only thing that we could figure is that maybe they're wild turkey tracks. And I wondered if you had any ideas, and if they are wild turkeys, are they prolific on the river? Are they native to our area? How does that work?
My guess is that they were probably great blue heron, and that would be more likely this time of the year near the river, the river's edge. But there could be wild turkeys. They're certainly there in the area. So those two would be the top picks. And so we might not ever know, especially if you didn't take a picture. And bird tracks are difficult, but there are a couple books that tell you how to tell those apart. And a lot of that stuff's online now. So if you come across that again, Tanya, take a picture and put something of known size in the picture.
A pen,
writing pen, or a quarter, or something that we all know what that size is, because that really helps give us a relative size so we can tell if that's large, medium, or small. So, but yeah. So maybe great blue heron. I mean, the heron makes more sense near the river's edge this time of the year. Most wild turkeys have left the bottoms this time of the year. They're up in the uplands usually this time of the year. And we've had so much rain. When the water goes up and down, it creates really good heron habitat. The fish get to go into the woods. The water goes down. There's puddles. And herons love that, because the fish can get trapped in those little oxbows and such. So I'm guessing a great blue heron. But you're right. It could be a wild turkey.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
if any of the listeners haven't actually been down to Fort Turan, I would encourage anybody to go down there and just take the day to explore, because the Neches is the last wild river. I mean, it's amazing.
It is. And there's a guide, a book that you can use that tells you where all the put-ins and take-outs are and approximately how long it'll take you in mile-wise. Between those two points, and that really helps. And so there's a lot of things out there to help you figure that stuff out. So, I'm glad you got to do that float trip. That sounds like a lot of fun.
It was. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That sounds beautiful down there, so I got to get down there. Now, it wouldn't be an egret then, you know, one of the great egrets?
It could be great egret. That one could be another possibility. Great blue's a little bit bigger, but both of those could be down there. Yeah, that would be another good pick.
Okay.
Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we did have a call there, but they're making a donation. So thank you very much. We'll get their name here shortly. So, but if you have a call about birds or birding, give us a call now. We still have about 5 to 8 minutes left in the show. We can take one or two more calls at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And in the meantime, we have a question here, and it's an interesting question. I like mockingbirds, but not everybody is a fan of them. And somebody wanted to know, how do you get my backyard mockingbird to quit singing through the night because he's keeping me awake? Yeah. That was me one time.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. So that's often where there's a bright light, a parking lot light, or if you've got a mercury vapor light or something like that in your yard, that can be very attractive to a mockingbird. And what's been found is that those males that are singing through the night are unmated, lonely birds that are looking for love. So they're putting it into hyperdrive by singing through the night, trying to find a girlfriend. So you should feel bad for the poor guy singing at the night, through the night, but he probably needs to get some rest, but he's in hyperdrive trying to find him some love.
There you go. So, well, you know, some of us experience that. Give us a call, 800-552-8502. I have John from Gilbert online now. John, what's your question with Cliff?
Well, it's actually not a question. It's a thank you.
Oh, okay.
All right.
For many years, back when I was sitting on the back porch of my grandparents about 64 years ago, they was telling me about the whippoorwills.
Uh-huh.
And I found out that there wasn't a whippoorwill from y'all.
Yeah, it's a Chuckwill's widow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just want to tell you something, that 64 years later, I know.
It probably brought back some good memories, though. That must have been good times back then, huh?
Oh, yeah.
And you're in Gilbert? Where are you from?
Gilmer, Texas.
Oh, Gilmer. Okay. Upshur County.
I saw Gilbert here.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I like that area, Gilmer. So, yeah, my grandfather was born in Upshur County in about 1916, so near Pritchett, if you know where Pritchett is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe you and he knew each other, but he passed away about 12 years ago.
Well, I know a lot of people. Most everybody knows me that's lived around here anytime.
Yeah, and they probably heard a lot of Chuckwill's widows over the years, and now you can go telling everybody that they're not whippoorwills. So.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's great, John. We appreciate the comment, and thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls, and we've got one more caller online, Woody from Lufkin. Please, we're running out of town, so if you could state your question quickly.
Yeah, there's a name that I've heard all my life called a rain crow.
Uh-huh.
And I identify it, to me, you hear like a knocking, really fast woodpecker kind of sound, generally in the evenings or after thunderstorms.
Yeah.
What is that thing?
Well, the rain crow is the yellow-billed cuckoo, and it makes a. I don't think do we have rain. Do we have yellow-billed cuckoo?
I don't think we profiled that one. We had yellow-breasted.
Yeah, we should bring in yellow-billed cuckoo next time. But that's the rain crow, and it doesn't. You know, the old timers. It kind of got messed up in translation. The old timers said they call right before rain and to get your slicker and your umbrella ready and your rubber boots. Well, that's not correct. They're actually one of the few birds that will keep vocal during a light rainstorm. Now, when it's a tremendous downpour, they're going to take a break and not sing, but it's a bird that will vocalize in a light drizzle, and that's the rain crow.
Is that the kind of a tat-tat-tat-tat-tat? Sort of a sound?
Yeah, I'll try to imitate it. So it's a go. That's one of the calls, and so
I've never heard that or anything close to that.
Yeah, so
it's it's more like a woodpecker just going nuts.
Well, so you're probably hearing something different, but if we're going to define what rain crow is, it's the only answer is yellow-billed cuckoo.
Okay, so that was one thing I always wanted.
Very good. Thanks for the call, Woody.
All right, thank you for your call. And Cliff, it's time for our conservation tip as we wind down this show. What do you got for us this month?
We're going to talk about keeping mosquitoes in control on your property. Any idea what the deadliest critter on the planet is? Snakes? Sharks? Nope. Neither of those. We've heard Dr. Beverly Burden on Red River Radio's popular radio show, What's Bugging You, explain how the tiny mosquito is the deadliest animal known to man. Globally speaking, these minuscule critters transmit several deadly diseases like malaria, dengue, yellow fever, encephalitis, West Nile, and Zika that annually kill tens of thousands of people in the world. In fact, during the construction of the Panama Canal in the early 1900s, the deaths of over 22,000 workers were attributed to mosquitoes breeding in the standing water humans created as they built the canal. A lot of lives were lost before they figured out that humans were unknowingly inflating the numbers of mosquitoes. Just like with the building of the Panama Canal, most of our mosquito problems are human-created. Things like roadside burrow ditches, old tires piled up, buckets, potted plant saucers, and clogged rain gutters, to name a few. All it takes is a quarter cup of stagnant water to create mosquito breeding grounds, and those hungry mosquitoes easily can fly to your neighbors one or two doors down. Thus, you have a role to play that will keep you and your neighbors safer and more comfortable. You can eliminate freestanding and stagnating water on your property. Spend some time each week, especially after rainstorm, patrolling your property for anything that's holding water that could soon stagnate and attract egg-laying mosquitoes. Don't rely on harmful pesticides, sprays, or a variety of other gimmicks. Instead, eliminate the source. Work alongside our birds to help them do their jobs, like the barn swallow that we profiled earlier in this episode that eats pesky insects. Do it for the birds.
All right, and Cliff, I want to thank you once again for joining us for another fun edition of Bird Calls, and we invite everybody to join us next month.
That was a lot of fun. Thank you for all you do, Bill.
Indeed, you bet. You have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Bird Calls is a production of Red River Radio. Our producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, and we had help tonight on our phone bank with Wally Derleth and the Toastmasters, who are here answering phones for our fund drive as well. The sound files used tonight on tonight's profile species were from xenocanto.org and were recorded by Paul Marvin. This month's bird photo was on our bird page was taken by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be posted a little later tonight because we've got a live show coming up at 8 o'clock. So that will be available early tomorrow morning. And remember, if you have a photo or a sound clip of a bird that you would like us to identify, you can send that to my email address at wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. Be sure to join us for the next installment of Bird Calls next month on Tuesday, July 9th, and the next edition of What's Bugging You will be coming up next Tuesday on June 18th. That is with Dr. Beverly Burden, and we hope you'll join us for that. And you are listening to Red River Radio. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is coming up next. Don't forget, tonight at 8 o'clock, we have live music with Curtis Joseph and friends, including Weldon Stutes, Nick Palmer, Sarah Smith, and Daniel Scott. They're going to be kicking up some beautiful jazz and ballads in there, and we hope you'll stay tuned for that. We have Radio Lab coming up next right here on Red River Radio, your voice of the community.